going to call the House Resource Committee to order. In attendance are Representative Gatto, Representative Olson, Co-Chair Samuels, myself, Representative Elkins, and Representative Ledoux. And we are going to take up House Bill 360 first. Representative Meyer, it's a great honor to have you here today.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman.
Let the record show that you are a good man, and we appreciate your time coming down to...
Thank you. It's indeed an honor for me to be here in the Resources Committee. I think this is my first time this year, so I've been looking forward to this, Mr. Chairman.
Be the smoothie?
I'm sorry?
You've been looking forward to the smoothie?
Yes, yes. No, this is a good committee. And, actually, the committee room has changed. This is a nice improvement. 360, Mr. Chairman, is that what you said? Water?
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
Okay. Again, thank you. And the bill before you is House Bill 360. And this came about after some of our finance subcommittee meetings that we had last session. And what we found as a subcommittee was that that there weren't any regulations or any monitoring over public drinking water systems for wells that serve 25 people or less. Now we do have we do monitor and regulate wells or public water systems that serve over 25 people, but for some reason under 25 people, that's currently not being regulated or monitored by DEC. Now this is the reason why this was a concern to us is that, as you know, Mr. Chairman, a lot of trailer parks, daycare centers, assisted living homes, etc., all have under 25 people, and we all know that the hazards, and it's in our file here, of water that's not safe to drink and the effects that can have. I've asked Kristen Ryan, who is the director of the Department of Environmental Health, to also testify on this bill because she certainly is more aware of the concern, the need, and the history than I am, Mr. Chairman. But I wanted to bring this bill forward for this committee's consideration because I do think it is a public health concern. I'll conclude with those remarks.
Chairman. Exceptional presentation. What is public health worth?
You can't put a dollar figure on it, Mr. Chairman.
Ooh.
Although I noticed the fiscal note is a little larger than I anticipated, but we can.
With all due respect, I think we'll take that up in Finance Committee.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Are there questions for the bill sponsor? Because it is a serious issue. It's an important issue, and bad things can happen in small places. Representative Ledoux.
How does this impact the villages around the state? And how does it, is there any interplay with a village fair safe water act?
It's a very good question, Representative Ledoux, through the chair. And could we save that for Ms. Ryan? She'd be.
Are you comfortable with that,
Representative Ledoux? Sure.
Thank you. You'll get a better answer.
Are there any questions for the sponsor? I'm sure he'll be available for a few minutes. Representative Gatto?
It was a similar question pertaining to, it only applies to public facilities. And so the question was, if you have a fourplex at a public facility, then it would fall under the over 25, but it could be under 25.
Yeah, the through the chair, Representative Gatto, there is a definition of public in statute, and I think, I don't know if we actually printed that out or not, but a fourplex would not be included. That would be
private,
yes. But if you had a private residency that you were using as a bed and breakfast, then that would be considered public, and then that would fall under this bill.
Are there any additional questions for the sponsor, Representative Ledoux?
So does that mean that if you live out in an area in which you have a well, and your rent, you've got a duplex, and so you live in one part of the duplex, and then you're renting out the other section of the duplex, that would apply to this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, no, that would not. If it's a rental property, it does not apply. This law does not apply to rental property. So if it's a duplex, fourplex, sixplex, eightplex.
What about a whole apartment building?
If it's over 25, then it would be under the current regulations. Apartment building, well, again, we'll ask Ms. Ryan, because she's the one that would be overseeing and monitoring this. If the apartment is under 25 people, I would we'll find out for sure from her, but I do not think this would apply. This is, it's only, the definition of public accommodation, it's pretty broad, but it includes mostly restaurants, hotels, taverns, nightclubs.
Representative Meyer, if I could interrupt, yes. You, Rep. Samuels has he can read the statute for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Public accommodation means a place that caters or offers its services, goods, or facilities to the general public, and includes a public inn, restaurant, eating house, hotel, motel, soda fountain, soft drink parlor, tavern, nightclub, roadhouse, place where food or spirits, that's a good word there, or malt liquors are sold for consumption, trailer park, resort, campground, barber shop, beauty parlor, bathroom, rest house, theater, swimming pool, skating rink, golf course, cafe, ice cream parlor, transportation company, and all other public amusement and business establishments.
Excellent.
We can still get whether a business establishment would be the rental place, but we can ask.
Yeah, I think that'd be a better question for her. Yes.
Representative.
Oh, sorry.
So where, I mean, like in Anchorage, you don't have wells in Anchorage, do you?
Yeah. The chair, yes, we do. Representative, we do. Surprisingly, we have quite a few wells yet in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before Kristen comes up, Jerry Van Sant is on the phone with the Department of Public Health. Jerry, are you with us?
Hello.
Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
How are you? Could you say your name and who you're with for the record and offer your testimony, please?
Okay. My name is Jerry Van Sant. That's spelled JERRIVAN, capital SANDT. I'm speaking on behalf of Dr. Monsager for the Division of Public Health, and we're calling in support of the bill. We had a few points we wanted to provide to the committee. It appears the bill wants clear authority to protect the public by establishing standards and reviewing water supply for small facilities, and that would include assisted living homes and other facilities licensed by certification licensing. We support the bill. We believe that certification licensing doesn't want to be in the water inspection business. It's outside of our scope and our expertise. And we would like the bill passed because we see it as it'll clarify that DEC has the authority to inspect the water systems. And if there's any issues or problems with a licensed facility, they would communicate that to us, and we would take the licensing actions necessary. That's all I have for you.
Excellent. Are there questions from Ms. Van Sant, from any of the members? Jerry, thank you very much for your testimony. We also have Dennis Wheeler on the line, who's available. Is with the with the RCA, I assume, with the regulating commission. But he's just available to answer any questions. With that, I think I'd like to have Director Ryan come up and explain some of the concerns raised by Representative Ledoux and any other points that you'd like to make on this bill.
For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the director for the Division of Environmental Health and the Department of Environmental Conservation. The regulation of public water systems falls within the Division of Environmental Health. And that right now is defined as how EPA restricts it to 25 or more people are served. Then we would regulate them using federal funds and state match that's currently allocated. The systems falling through the cracks are these smaller systems that serve 25 people or less that provide services to the public, I think is the intent mainly of the legislation, or that's how at least DEC is interpreting it. The concept that if you take your child to a daycare or you're in an office building and you're drinking out of the water fountain or a gas station, that somebody has looked at the water and made sure it's safe to consume, or at least there be some kind of warning that it is not. That it is not being regulated. We have problems right now in our restaurants where we regulate about 100 of them for food, but they fall under the classification for water. So we are not regulating them for drinking water, but we are for food. So that's been causing some problems within the department. To get to Representative Ledoux's questions, the interpretation that I'm making with the definition of public accommodations is that it would not include residential facilities such as apartment buildings or homes or duplexes, that the intent is to get at facilities that provide services to the public. And now you could probably define apartments as a service to the public, and that's definitely something we can consider. But at this point, the way other legislation that's been similarly addressed, for example, pesticides, it's sort of buyer beware. If you rent a place or you buy a home, you typically have the responsibility to see if the water has been tested recently or if the septic system is working correctly. That's how it's been done to point. So.
Representative Ledoux?
Well, of course, there's the fiscal note as to what it might cost the state. Does anybody have any idea of what it might cost private industry?
Mm-hmm. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, we estimate, I'll give some statistics, we estimate there are about 3,000 of these facilities out there. There are probably about 5,000 of these small facilities. So about 2,000 serve homes, private homes. And about 3,000 serve a public facility like a grocery store or all the other things we've already mentioned. What we would require to regulate them is an annual test of nitrate and an annual total coliform test. Those cost about $30 each to run at a private laboratory. If the system was surface water, which it means there's more potential for contamination, we would require that the system was designed by a certified engineer, private engineer. So that would be a cost to the system. And that's, at this point, the way the bill's drafted would be the expenses to these systems.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Chair Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 1, line 8, the water supply system. So if you're on AWWU, it's being tested, and you don't have to worry. If you have an individual business, if you're operating cars or whatever,
correct,
and you've got people that come and go, or you have more employees than 25, do you also have to test at the user end then? Is that considered a water supply system, or is AWWU considered the water supply system?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, those water systems are already regulated by the federal system that's got a very elaborate and extensive requirements placed upon them, and it is tested at AWWU. They have, depending on what they're testing for, have requirements that they test at the tap for certain things like lead and copper, because that is picked up through the distribution system, but that would be dealt with through the regulation of AWWU, not the user of that water.
So if you're on city water, then this doesn't affect you?
Correct.
At all. You're just looking at individual wells. And have there been any problems anywhere in the state or nationwide? Have you seen other problems? I mean, are you addressing a problem that doesn't exist? Or
Representative Samuels, through the chair, there have been outbreaks of waterborne illness throughout history. I mean, that is the number one reason children die in the world, actually, is because of inadequate water. I can't give you any specifics about Alaska. It's very difficult to predict sometimes if the reason there's dysentery is from the water. But I can give you instances in other states where there have been people recently that have died from exposure to E. coli from private wells.
If I could, so you stated a second ago it'd be like $30 for, I own a business in Kodiak and I'm on a well. Now, DEC is going to go in and what happens if there's non-compliance, if DEC does not go in and check, and me as a business owner don't know I'm supposed to do this, is there a penalty or is it DEC's responsibility to make sure it gets done? And then what's the penalty for non-compliance?
Representative through the chair, right now the samples we would require, this is how we'd interpret it right now, that the samples would have to be tested at a DEC certified laboratory. Those exist throughout the state because our larger public water systems are using them, and it's a requirement of EPA that we approve private labs to test public drinking water, but it is done by private industry. It's not done by DEC. We do maintain a laboratory capacity because we're required to in case there's emergencies, but we don't do the testing primarily. If there were non-compliance, it would fall to DEC to follow up on that. And there could be multiple types of non-compliance. One could be a hot sample. Say we get a fecal coliform result that shows positive. Our immediate response would be to the water system to issue a boil water notice or to not allow people to drink that water. That's would be our first response. If they are not sampling, we don't know what's in the water, and it would be incremental enforcement and of issuing of notice of violations to encourage them to sample, having staff that are in that community perhaps go out and talk to them to explain the technical reasons why it's important or the public health reasons why they should be sampling. It's our standard business to help people comply, and that requires people's staff to do that.
And DEC would follow up on the record keeping?
Representative through the chair, that's part of the fiscal note, yeah. That we would have a registration process, so they would have to register with us so we know they existed and that they were sending their samples were coming into us so we knew what the results were.
Okay. Thank you.
Kristen, I've got a couple of questions for you. If we get back to the fourplex.
Okay.
If I have a fourplex and I allow one of the tenants to bring a daycare in, six children, would that unit then be subject to water testing for the protection of those kids in the fourplex? Is that a correct understanding?
That's how I would interpret it, yeah.
Okay.
Providing services to the public would include a daycare.
Okay.
And Representative Meyer did touch on it. These water systems do tend to serve some of our more vulnerable populations, adult residential care facilities regulated by the health department, preschools regulated by education and
okay.
Stuff like that.
And our friend Representative Crawford has joined us. And then the last question for me, when you briefed me on this particular issue, you went into some detail about how this was a viable program, funding source for it tailed off to the point at which we weren't servicing the program properly. This is an effort to bring back safety to these small vulnerable groups. Can you just, for the benefit of Representative Ledoux and other members of the committee, just give us just a couple of minutes on that particular
Absolutely. I'll give
analogy.
You a history of how we got here today. In 1971, actually, I'll go back pretty far, but I'll be quick, the Department of Environmental Conservation was created in statute. And in that statute, it included that the department regulate public water systems. It took until about 78 for the department, for EPA to grant DEC primacy, allowing us to regulate the larger federal systems. We don't have as good a records about Class Cs, or what we call the smaller water systems. But we assume about 1980, the federal government tightened its definition of what public water system meant. And up until that point, it was much broader. So that was the point that the state decided that it would need to take on its own regulation and funding for these smaller systems that serve the public. It was broader, though, and it included all 5,000 of these establishments. So it had DEC regulating homes and duplexes and triplexes, had everything except a single-family home or a duplex. That's how the definition is written in current regulations, which are in the process of being repealed. That funding was about 100 and $10,000 to regulate 5,000 establishments. It was not adequate, and we were not doing any technical assistance or any enforcement or any follow-up that that was really sufficient to ensure protecting the public health. So 4 years ago, reductions were made in the department's budget, and this was the area that was reduced. So the funding has completely gone away. The regulations are in the process of being repealed. The change, or the difference about this legislation, is it restricts what we would regulate to only those systems serving the public and not all of these small water systems that serve private homes as well.
Excuse me, Representative Ledoux.
I had asked Representative Mayer how this interplayed with the Village Safe Water program. Do you have any comments about that?
Yes, thank you for reminding me. I'm sorry, I forgot. Representative Ledoux, through the chair. The Village Safe Water program, among other agencies out there, constructs public water systems and sewer systems and actually some landfills for rural Alaskan communities. Those are larger public water systems. Those are all above 25 people, or they are not allowed to be funded by those resources. That funding is tied to Alaska's primacy of the drinking water program, which means it's only for systems larger than 25 people. So this does have no impact that I'm aware of on village or small community water systems, but any, you know, obviously a daycare facility or public service facility out there would be impacted, wherever they are in the state.
Well, if the community has one of those safe water systems, wouldn't all of the houses in the community have?
Hopefully. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, and you, Kevin touched on it too, there's, even in Anchorage, there's thousands of people on private wells, thousands of grocery stores and restaurants. I know of a Wendy's that's on a private well in the middle of Anchorage. So even though there's public water systems in your vicinity, you have the you're not required to hook into it. Some people choose not to.
Why would somebody in the middle of Anchorage be on a private? I just don't understand this.
I can't speak for them. I don't know why.
Grandfathering or?
Yeah, it's cheaper. They had the well. It works. Yeah. It's good water.
Hopefully.
Yes, hopefully.
Are there other questions? Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under that little laundry list of public accommodations that I read off, the last one was all other business establishments. So I hate to what if you to death, but I'm going to. So what if you've got a one-man shop in his own home who might have customers come by? He has no clue that we're about to probably pass this bill from committee here. And do you cross-check with business licenses? Is he going to? I'm working in my own home, and I'm a computer programmer. Now, technically, I am a public accommodation as a business establishment. I realize that's not who you're after, but.
Representative, through the chair, you're correct. It is not what we're after. The intent is clearly to regulate those systems that provide water to the public. And I think we can probably work something out in regulations so that those smaller facilities are private businesses that aren't regularly giving water to customers aren't captured in this.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You mentioned lead, but you singled it out, and I think it's going to test all the heavy metals.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, these smaller systems aren't right now, and our regulations we're repealing required to test for anything but total coliform and nitrates. Those are acute health risks. Those are things that are an indicator of E. coli or some other incidents that will kill somebody. Chronic contaminants like heavy metals, which a little bit over a long period of time may harm you, are not as much a concern to us just because the risk is lower. But obviously, if somebody's getting their water tested at a lab, they would have that opportunity to have other things tested. But we really wanted to just capture the bare minimum immediate health risk here.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Ryan? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on House Bill 360? All right, we have nobody else on line. Mr. Wheeler, do you have any remarks you'd like to make?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dennis Wheeler with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I don't have any testimony to offer. I
do understand that a memorandum that we have written is available regarding the interplay of this legislation with the RCA's jurisdiction.
Give us just one moment. Do you want to give us an overview of that while we're looking at our packets for that memorandum?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, the RCA's statutory jurisdiction and our regulations have an interplay such that we would not be involved in regulating these particular systems except in the very narrowest of circumstances, which we've currently exempted by regulation. In other words, these would not be the type of public utility by statutory definition that we would involve ourselves with.
I see. So it's not your concern?
That is correct, sir.
That's the extent of your testimony and the memo?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think we'll proceed then. Thank you very much, Mr. Wheeler. Seeing nobody else that wishes to testify on this, public testimony is closed. Is there any discussion on HB 360? Chair Samuels.
Chairman, I move HB 360 from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendation.
Without objection, HB 360 will move from resources. Representative Meyer, if it's all right with you, we'd like to take up HB 380. Is that right? Is that...
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Meyer, representing Anchorage. The bill you have before you is House Bill 380, and this is based on the hard work that the DEC has been doing over the interim. They've been looking at their statute as it pertains primarily to the state veterinarian. And what we found is that a lot of the references in the and duties and powers as it pertains to the state veterinarian had to do with, it hasn't been changed since 1949. So they refer to animals as livestock. They refer to a lot to fur farms, which, as you know, I don't think we even have any fur farms anymore. So what we're trying to do is just update, modernize the statutes. As I said, they haven't been looked at since the 1940s, 1950s. To give you an example of a couple areas of concern, is one is that the department has no authority to quarantine an animal if they so desire, if they feel a need to, unless it's considered livestock. This poses a concern, as you know, with the avian flu fortunately, not a problem yet in this state. We hope it's never a problem in this state, but certainly could be because of our location and all the world travelers that we have. Right now, with our current statute, the way it's written and being written for the 1940s, 1950s, it's unclear right now if there wasn't concern or breakout of avian flu, who would be in charge of it? Would it be Fish and Game? Would it be DEC? Would it be another agency? So the various agencies involved got together over the interim, and they've worked out and filled some of these gaps. And that's basically what this bill does: is it makes it clear who's responsible for what in case there is a major epidemic like this, or how we can prevent an epidemic like this. A lot of the technical questions you may have, I would like to refer to the various department heads that are here. Mr. Chairman, but it's a good bill. Thank you.
Just take your word for it.
Yes, sir. Are there questions for the sponsor? Representative Meyer, do you have an amendment that you wanted to have the committee adopt?
Mr. Chairman, I know there is an amendment. I don't believe I have that. Do you? Mr. Pulaski, Mr. Fish. Do you have that?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Michael Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. I believe the amendment was forwarded to your able staff, and it should be available for the committee. It's actually something that the Department of Health asked us to consider adding to the bill, and I believe they should be available to testify as to the reasons.
Thank you. I have a copy of it. Does anybody else have a copy of it in their packet? All the members? All right. Without, if there, is there an objection? To without objection, somebody want to move conceptual amendment to number one?
Move amendment number one, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, amendment number one is moved. And are there questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just on section two, I was looking at the sectional where it talks about the state veterinarian, and we are essentially saying that, you know, fur farms is not the big deal anymore, but some other things are. I'm not sure what the powers of the state veterinarian are. Can the vet go to on private property and say that, you know, my understanding from your neighbors is that you have, pick an animal that might not be qualified under livestock. Maybe you have songbirds, maybe you have monkeys, maybe you have some things. Can the state vet impose himself upon a private party?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, I have an idea or a thought on this, but again, we do have the state veterinarian online, or maybe in the audience. He's online, and that would be a better question for him.
Mm-hmm. Who would be the state veterinarian?
All right. Do we know who the state veterinarian is?
Bob Gerlach.
Bob Gerlach is? Okay. Mr. Gerlach, are you with us?
This is Bob Gerlach.
All right. We're going to take testimony from you in a few minutes, but if you wouldn't mind, could you answer that question for Representative Gatto?
And I'm going to repeat it, Mr. Gerlach. Basically, does the state vet have police powers to be able to enter upon private property?
Only with respect to the specific species of animals that are in statute. And that was a problem that was many states faced in 2003 when monkeypox broke out, and it was going to be an example I was going to testify on, but basically when monkeypox had broken out and started to affect people, it was found that the virus was being transmitted by prairie dogs, and the Midwestern states that had the outbreak, it was mostly in Wisconsin and Illinois, found that the public health and state veterinarian neither could go in to confiscate these animals or gather these animals and control the spread of the disease. As best they could do would be to try to make some type of quarantine around the outside of the building so that the animal wouldn't move from that building.
Do you have a follow-up on that issue, Representative Gatto?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I guess the concern is that in the year 2006, and you're probably tired of hearing it, rapid global movements of animals, certainly migrating waterfowl, fish farms, there seem to be vectors other than the ones that we are currently aware of that may become emergencies for us in the future. Or would this bill allow you to seize upon a situation that comes before us that seems a crisis and allow you to act very quickly, or would you have to then rather go put a barrier around the residents in the hopes that ultimately you will be able to gain access in the interest of public health?
The bill that's before you would allow the state veterinarian to take action and control a disease outbreak that was initiated by a species, a novel species, or any animal.
I,
If I may, Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I would direct Representative Gatto through the chair to Section 3 of the bill, which I do believe carries out the powers that you're talking about, the ability to inspect a premises. And that designee of the commissioner in this case would be the state veterinarian.
And that's really the section that I was dealing with in that I didn't, you know, I'd like to know that somebody in the state doesn't need to have the troopers come with them if we have an individual who says, I don't care. Maybe he's got a house full of monkeys, and my guess is they're all infected. And he says, I have my rights. Do you have to have police powers to deal with that situation, or do you have those powers, or can you deal with it just as the vet who represents the state?
Mr. Gerlach?
You would, with this bill, would give you the power to be able to act on that issue or that outbreak of that disease and go in and quarantine an animal to a premise and then work through the need through the investigation to see if those animals would need to be exterminated or put to sleep to remove the threat to public health.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gerlach. We'll take the rest of your testimony here in a few minutes. Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor, for Mr. Pulaski, while we have them? I think we're fine.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Meyer, Mr. Pulaski. All right, with that, Mr. Gerlach, I think we'll take any testimony that you have to offer.
Okay, I just have a short statement, and I think the many of the issues have been brought up is basically in the current rapid pace of disease emergence that we've noticed in the beginning of the 21st century has really created some new challenges for the management and control of animal and public health diseases. The emergence of new diseases has been mostly associated with people's interactions with animals, and it's now recognized that over 70% of these new emerging diseases are actually affecting human health and human economies. They're zoonotic diseases, so they're animal diseases that infect people. In the past, infectious disease has always been controlled and regulated according to a pretty artificial system. We looked at diseases of livestock, diseases of wildlife, diseases of pets, and then diseases of humans in four separate categories. We know now that infectious diseases are rarely restricted to one individual species, and they are very rarely contained by any type of artificial or geographic political boundary. They spread, and their control can be very difficult. Diseases can be introduced into a new area through a number of routes, and for example, we look at some current issues that have been in the press. We've seen animal imports bringing diseases into new areas, and we've talked a little bit about monkeypox. African rodents were imported into the United States, mixed with some pet rodents at some pet distributors. These animals were moved around through several states in the Midwest, and it resulted in the exposure of people to monkeypox. And the concern was monkeypox is very similar presentation to smallpox. So there was a great concern about an emergence of this type of disease in the human population. But we also have diseases being moved by animal products, importation and movement of animal products. We've got the consumption of meat products that have been contaminated with prions that are thought initially only to be in the brain and spinal cord of animals. This was the cause of the spread of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or mad cow disease, in human beings, and brought the very, very big concern with border closures and isolation of Canada and a tremendous economic burden to Canada. And actually, through the subsequently with the finding of the disease in the United States, has also brought some problems and issues with our own trade. The shipment of other products has been also associated with diseases such as the the movement of E. coli or Campylobacter salmonella in improperly cooked meat products can spread the disease throughout the public and cause public health disease outbreaks in many areas. And we've seen that in the lower 48 with the outbreaks of E. coli 0157 in hamburger that was improperly cooked at fast food restaurants. There have also been issues just very recently with milk and dairy products that have been contaminated with Listeria, tuberculosis, brucellosis, E. coli again, and the most recently large outbreak that occurred just in December in Oklahoma, where a cow that had rabies milk had gotten into public commerce and resulted in 45 people needing to have rabies prophylaxis as a try to control the perceived risk of in public health. We also have diseases being moved by just regular animal movement, and it was mentioned previously with avian influenza, wild migratory birds flying and possibly spreading this disease. We've also had, in the lower 48, noted spread of chronic wasting disease and white-tailed deer in wild populations moving to bring the disease into new areas and to the farthest reaches in the eastern part of the United States this past year in West Virginia and in New York State. We also have what was mentioned before about insect vectors being able to spread these diseases. So we do have a number of ways diseases can move and then impact not just animals but people. But we also have concerns for new emerging diseases that are presented in a new fashion. We've got diseases that have been around for a long while that we thought we had under control through regulatory matters, and now we find that we don't have such good control of them. Diseases such as tuberculosis and brucellosis, that we've had several outbreaks in both wildlife and in livestock in the lower 48 that have resulted in a number of states, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, California, Arizona, and Texas, losing their designation as either TB or brucellosis-free state. This has resulted in a number of trade problems for animal movement in those states. Right now, Alaska is both TB and brucellosis-free. This allows animals to move in and out of the states, that disease-free classification, so that they're not burdened by increased regulatory testing. That makes it a lot easier for animals and producers to move animals back and forth. It's much more economical. We've also had these more commonplace diseases that have been around that we thought we had under control reemerge as causing public health problems being spread by animals because of development of antibiotic resistance. We've got E. coli again, 0157, salmonella. Tuberculosis has been a large public health problem that has been reemerged and found to be very resistant to our normal control and antibiotic treatments. So the consequence of all these disease outbreaks has had major impact on both animal health, public health, as well as regional and national economies. Right now in Alaska, there's no state agency that has the authority to manage all types of animals, domestic, wild, or exotic animals. And these animals may carry disease that will and can threaten the state's animal resources as well as the public resources, public health resources in the state. So the current authority that's restricted in the state veterinarian's venue is limited to livestock and poultry and the fur farms. And I can just give you two examples in the past of how we've been very lucky in being able to manage problems in the state. It was back in February 2004, there was an outbreak of a disease on Kodiak, right in the fairgrounds. We had several horses that got sick. When the owners noted that they were ill, called the veterinarian out to check the animals. Within 12 to 24 hours, these animals were dead. We started an investigation, worked with our office at the state veterinarian with local practitioners, the USDA and the University of Fairbanks, to try to work through this disease investigation. Public health was notified, but in order to try to control the spread of a disease like that, we needed to try to stop animal movement so that we would have it restricted to one area. No person had the authority to stop all animal movement on and off the islands because we had pets that could be moved on and off, livestock, wildlife. And then there were animals that would be exhibition animals. We'd for game farms or for zoos or presentations like that. We had no one that would be able to stop all movement of animals. We were very fortunate is that we were able to work cooperatively with the Coast Guard, the Department of Transportation, and private airline carriers to stop the movement of animal movement on and off the island until we were able to define what was the cause of the death of these horses and would be able to contain it if it was an infectious disease. Just past summer of 2005, we had a dog kennel operator out in the valley ordered ducks to be imported into the state so that he could use them to train hunting dogs and as well as for dog trials. Within the first 3 weeks of these 500 ducks that were imported into the state, we had a loss of 200 of those ducks to sudden death. Fortunately, the poultry producer called, and we were able to start a disease investigation. But the problem is poultry or the ducks aren't really considered poultry. That was outside of the our regulatory authority. We were able to work cooperatively with the USDA and our office, and the owner agreed of the ducks and at the kennel to agree to the disease control measures that we wanted to institute to try to stop the spread of this disease and avoid contamination of local poultry operations as well as the wildlife. And basically, we had a quarantine of the facility. We canceled all the dog trials until we could determine the cause of the disease. We went in and sampled the remaining ducks. And to make a long story short, the ducks were treated with an antibiotic until we could get our diagnostic test done. The disease condition was under control with the antibiotics, and we found through our testing that we weren't dealing with avian influenza, because that was an outbreak that was occurring back in Southeast Asia at the time period these ducks had become ill and died. So in the past, investigations have been successfully managed and controlled with voluntary cooperation of all partners. But in the future, we really need to have some clear statutory authority in situations where we have an animal disease outbreak to be able to protect the animal resources of the state, both domestic and wildlife resources of the state, as well as to protect public health.
Mr. Gerlach?
Thank you.
Yes, sir. We're very grateful to have a person of your expertise in this state and not in Hollywood writing screenplays that could frighten the general public. You're very knowledgeable about a broad area of concerns that I'm very grateful for your testimony. Just for the record, would you state your name and who you're with DEC, please?
Yes, I'm Bob Gerlach. I'm the state veterinarian with the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Okay, and also, Mr. Gerlach, before we open up to questions from the committee, would you make a note, please, to call my office. Our phone number is 465-3004. You can ask for Jim Pound, and we want to discuss the absence of veterinary programs at the university system across the state of Alaska and the inability to source witchy grants so that we can bring more veterinarians in here. That was a constituent brought that to my attention, that we have a scarcity of veterinarians. I see Ms. Ryan from the DEC nodding her head. So we have a scarcity of veterinarians in this state. We don't have a university program that allows us to cultivate more in-state veterinarians. So as a result, we require people to go out of state, change residency, get a veterinarian certificate to come back into this state to participate in the meaningful dialogue that you just brought to our attention. So with that, I'll open up any questions from members. I mean, thank you for your help. Any questions for is it Dr. Gerlach? Is that right, sir?
That's correct.
Okay. My apologies for not introducing you that way. I respect people who study veterinary medicine. Any questions for Dr. Gerlach? I think the thoroughness of your presentation satisfied the committee, Dr. Gerlach, and I thank you. We will look forward to speaking to you about that, because I had some young people that had precisely that concern. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just curious, all those dead ducks you refer to, what you said sudden death, what was the common thread among all those ducks?
The ducks happened to pick up a bacterial disease called Pasteurella, what we would normally call avian cholera, that caused the rapid growth of the bacteria in the intestinal tract and resulted in the death of the ducks. Unfortunately, we were not informed about the incident immediately, that part of the problem is that you've mentioned is that we need to have more outreach education to producers and animal owners so that they have an interaction with local veterinarians and to provide that local veterinary support so that our office, the Office of State Veterinarian, can assist local practitioners in these disease investigations and control.
Representative Gutter?
Just a small follow-up, slightly askew of where we are, but I was talking to Ms. Ryan, and that possibly one of the causes of the potato blight in Interior and Mat-Su Valley, Alaska, has been the use of imported seed that someone can simply get over the internet. So importing untested seed or untested birds or seems to be something that's getting to be, at least now we have it in both the potatoes, tomatoes, and it's a problem, and now we're talking about ducks and a number of things. As the state vet, do you feel it's going to be important in time to say, listen, we can't just allow Alaska Airlines to drop off someone's exotic pet, but that we can't introduce a new species from somewhere else without a quarantine?
I think that we do need to be able to control and track animal imports as well as other products or that would be vectors for disease that would threaten our resources, and that has been a big issue. And I think it's being recognized by a number of different states, and the fact that it's a very common practice for poultry to be ordered through the mail or through the internet and be shipped through the postal service. And that's probably one of our largest challenges is to try to regulate the movement of both animals and products through the mail service that is at this point unregulated.
Thank you, Dr. Gerlach. Any other questions for Dr. Gerlach? Seeing none, we thank you very much for your testimony, sir. If we can go to Louisa Castrodale with Department of Public Health, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, would you state your name and the capacity in which you serve DPH, please?
Sure. My name is Dr. Louisa Castrodale. I work in the Section of Epidemiology, Division of Public Health, Health and Social Services, and I'm testifying on behalf of Dr. Richard Monsager, who's our director of the Division of Public Health.
Thank you, Dr. Castrodale. Please present your testimony.
Okay, thanks so much for this opportunity. I just wanted to mention that I'm going to convey the full support of this bill from Dr. Monsager, the director of the Division of Public Health. We do have a small amendment to add, and I think that's what maybe you were referring to right when you started out with this bill. Do you have that in front of you?
Yes, we've already adopted.
After that, okay. Do you want me to speak a little bit more to that, or since it's adopted, it doesn't need any more?
Yes, if you could be very brief, it says the compendium of animal rabies prevention and control.
Right. This is a document that it's revised nationally every year, and so this is just a technicality to take out the specific year, 2002, and make it more of a ability to just refer to that document as it comes out each year, so it's the most up to date, and so that's just what the amendment asks.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Castrodale. Do you have any other general comments other than DPH's support of HB 380?
No, we work very closely with Dr. Gerlach and DEC, and we're pleased to sponsor this or support this.
Thank you, Dr. Castrodale. Any questions for the doctor? Thank you very much for your assistance today, Doctor. We appreciate it a lot. We have Larry DeVilbiss from Division of Agriculture, who is also on the line to answer any questions. Are there any questions for Director DeVilbiss? Representative Prado, do you want to ask him about the seeds and the potato blight? Is that a concern of yours? Are you with us, Larry?
I am.
Yeah, Larry, thanks. Glad to hear from you. Just a question. You know, I think I told you I'd been to Dearborn's and seen the contaminated tomatoes in the greenhouses and talked to the farmers there about the potato blight. I think we did discuss that possibility that it was a result of imported seed, and I'm just asking you now, I think it would be a good time and place to consider the, what's the best information we have right now.
Yes, Representative Gatto, good to talk to you. Our latest information, and it's not completely conclusive yet because they've narrowed down the strains to two, both of which have their origins in tomato plants. So we're reasonably sure that's where this started. And, of course, we are responsible for doing in the plant kingdom what Dr. Gerlach and DEC is responsible for in the animal kingdoms. And I do support this. We have worked closely with Dr. Gerlach and DEC in formulating this, so we appreciate your support.
Any questions for Director DeVilbiss, Division of Agriculture, Representative Gatto?
Just a question, Larry. Do you have any connection with importation as a result of our originating in the tomatoes?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Well, you mentioned that the origin of the potato blight seemed to be the tomatoes. Is there something about importing that's connected to the source for the tomatoes?
It's very likely that the vector was imported tomato plants that came in, and we have put the major importers on notice that they need to come with certification of being blight-free, and when they don't, we issue a cease and desist order on their sales. We do that regularly with both potatoes and tomatoes, but this got through somewhere.
Thank you. Any additional questions? We thank you very much, Director DeVilbiss. Appreciate you joining us today. Is there anybody else here that would like to testify on House Bill 380? All right. With that, we'll close public testimony and discussion amongst the committee. Excellent. Anybody like to entertain a motion to move this bill?
Chairman, I move House Bill 380 from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Without objection, HB 380 moves from this committee. Representative Meyer, Mike Pulowski, thank you very much for spending time with us today. Doing an excellent presentation. Thank you. Okay, we are going to take up House Bill 395. And presenting this bill for Representative Olson Day is Conrad Jackson. You're a good man, too.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, as Representative Ramos pointed out, my name is Conrad Jackson. Staff to Representative Kurt Olson. Before you today is House Bill 395, an act extending the period of the fire season. HB 395 simply adds 1 month to the beginning of the current season. By this simple change to April 1st from a May 1st start date, our firefighting personnel and equipment will be in place and just better prepared for the early season fires. Fuel sources such as spruce bark beetle kill trees are on the increase. Statewide precipitation is trending downward. Temperatures are trending upward. All of these factors make Alaska just ripe for more early season fires. And this is exactly what this bill would help combat. As a little history, just on the Southern Peninsula alone, in the past few years, they've had a number of wildfires start prior to May 1st, the beginning of the current fire season. In 2003, there were 14 fires. In 2004, there were four, including one 100-acre fire that was just north of Anchor Point. In 2005, there were 8 fires, including the Tracy Avenue fire. It was just east of Homer that was comprised of about 5,400 acres. This was one of the earliest large complex fires in state history. Similar fire activity can be seen in the Valley, the Fairbanks area, the Anchorage Bowl area. These early season fires have the potential to be devastating if not actively fought. Without proper equipment and personnel in place, these fires are able to get a stronger hold and can be difficult to contain and then ultimately extinguish. The quick and aggressive attack of these fires in its early stages is critical to the protection of life and property. The lovely little pictures you have there in front of you just give you a little bit of an idea of some of the current beetle kill stands that are across the peninsula, as well as some of the structures that are located around the roadways, that type of thing. The second one also shows some of the locations of the fires caused both by man and lightning strikes. Just a little bit of background there. It also shows a couple of the fires. You can see, for instance, the Tracy Avenue fire from last year, pretty close to Homer, and a real threat to a number of folks down there. The Southern Peninsula is just one example that I think is deems needs some real attention. And it's not just the homes and businesses that are really endangered by these fires. It's also the critical infrastructure that serves many areas, roads, electrical lines. Without those, we're in a real hurt. Mr. Chairman, that's really all I have today. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions of the members.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. In reading the bill, it seems like the commissioner can designate other periods as fire seasons. That's in lines 5 and 6. If he can already designate other periods, does that not allow him to designate April?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, yes, sir, it does. This simply puts it into statute and just encourages some activity on bringing the equipment. Bringing the equipment under contract, beginning the training, retraining of personnel to make sure that they are prepared to fight those early season fires. There's nothing that obviously would prohibit the commissioner from starting the fire season in March even.
Just a point of order. The chair is supportive of its members, and I would not be so mischievous as to call you Representative Gatto while I'm trying to address the...
I think it's my wife.
You want us to go to somebody else? Representative Elkins?
Has there been a concentrated effort to log the beetle kill to get the fire danger down?
Yeah, Representative Elkins, through the chair, there has been some effort. In fact, Homer Electric Association has put quite a bit of work into it. You can see on the first map, the purple is some areas that have been logged pretty extensively. But if you also notice, there's a lot of areas in yellow that are the structures that have no purple near them, which means there are still a lot of beetle kill trees around structures, around the roads, around the electrical system. So it's sort of a mixed answer, yes and no. There's a bunch of dead trees out there. There's a bunch of standing matchsticks.
Excellent. And if I may, for the committee, we have we happen to be fortunate enough to have a lot of firemen visiting the building, and about a half a dozen that are ready to testify. They're signed in to testify on this bill. So I think we can speak with some of the best experts across the state on this issue, with all due respect, because you're an expert also, Conrad, but without a hat or a helmet.
Perfectly understandable, Mr. Chair.
Co-chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd follow up on what Representative Gatto asked. The commissioner may designate other seasons. Has he done so? And if so, then why the fiscal note of almost $1 million, then, if we're already doing I realize what you're trying to do is back up so they do it all the time, but
right.
for an extra million, are we already spending some of that money earlier anyway?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, there is money being spent, such as last year with the Tracy Arm fire. I don't have exact figures, but it's more on a crisis basis, a hurry up, let's get this going because we've got something burning down right now, as opposed to being prepared ahead of time. Like most anything, if you're prepared ahead of time, it's actually going to be less expensive than a hurry-up rush.
My point on the $1 million.
Yes. Yeah. I would have to defer to the Division of Forestry, who's prepared the fiscal note to maybe fine-tune the answer a little bit.
Thank you.
Okay. Prime sponsor.
Yeah, I think a good portion of that is the response time. They have moved it back, but it's slowed down the initial response in the first few hours of the first day is. Crucial to getting, you know, to knocking it down or at least controlling it. I think I would defer to the gentleman sitting to my left more on that. But this just isn't a peninsula issue. It's from Fairbanks all the way down through the valley in Anchorage, and a good portion of our equipment on the peninsula is stored in Palmer, I believe. But it would just allow us to respond, you know, much quicker. You know, we've dodged the bullet for the last few years, but anybody who's been down on the peninsula last summer knows what a tinderbox we have, and I would imagine, judging by the fires up in Fairbanks, it's about the same up there.
Yes, sir.
So you're right. It is going to cost $1 million, but I think it's money well spent.
Representative Ledoux?
I was wondering whether there was any particular incident in which the commissioner had not moved the designation or designated a certain time period which may have precipitated this bill.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I believe, if I understand your question, when a fire happens, the commissioner says go. So I don't think there's a case of anyone waiting around saying, well, we can maybe wait till the first to attack this fire. In the critical time, the beginning of that fire, they're still moving to suppress the fire.
No, I understand that when a fire occurs, but I mean, if you look at the statute right now, it says the commissioner may designate other periods as fire seasons. So was there a case where somebody had asked the commissioner to, for example, designate April as a fire season in which the commissioner hadn't perhaps moved quickly enough and did not do that, that kind of precipitated this bill?
I see. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I'm afraid I can't answer that. Again, possibly someone from the Division of Forestry or DNR, who's here, I believe, also.
Thank you.
Representative Olson?
I know of at least one fire service area that has requested.
Pardon me?
I know of at least one fire service area being Central Emergency Services that covers the middle portion of the Kenai Peninsula that has asked that it's been moved up in the past, but it hasn't happened.
Thank you.
Other questions for the sponsor? Representative Gatto?
Just a question. Is it beetle kill, essentially, that is the primary concern, which is why we want to make sure we're ready ahead of time?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that's just one of the many concerns. Obviously, there is not as much spruce bark beetle kill up towards the central part of the state. But on the central area, or the south central, I'm sorry, spruce bark beetle is a very big concern. Yes, sir.
I know from the interior that we've had, and speaking to DNR, we've had as many as 11,000 lightning strikes in a single day in the state. So it's, you know, whether it's tinder or just frequency, there's a lot of volatility out there. Representative Ledoux?
I'm just wondering if this this equipment and so forth, is that just going to be available in the Homer Kenai area, or is that going to be available all around the state? Because I know I've got some places that have quite a bit of beetle kill.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, this would be statewide. This is opens a fire season statewide.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the sponsor? All right. We thank you very much, Conrad. And if we go to Mr. Powell, who is the state fire marshal. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Hi, sir.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Gary Powell, the Alaska State Fire Marshal and the Director of the Division of Fire Prevention. Here to testify in support of HB 395. The wildfire season certainly is beginning earlier and earlier every year, and over the past several years, I think we've seen some evidence of that. It's desirable to prevent spring wildfires, which are primarily man-caused, in my estimation. And if the prevention efforts fail, then it's critical these fires are detected early and suppressed quickly. This can only be accomplished with well-trained and properly equipped personnel in place prior to the fire activity beginning. Both the prevention and suppression efforts require folks to be on the ground, ready to go, trained and equipped. The prevention is accomplished by a number of avenues, but a couple of the most noteworthy are issuing burn permits, so we have some control over that, and then by conducting public education efforts, either as the permits are issued or at other venues. And again, it takes folks to do that. Suppression obviously is accomplished by trained and equipped firefighting personnel. It's critical that the fire season begin early enough to get these crucial resources in place before the events occur. And that's the conclusion of my brief remarks, but I would answer any questions that the committee might have.
Representative Ledoux.
I think this is a really good bill, and maybe this goes a little bit further than the bill, but what can we do about this beetle kill so that we're not waiting for the fires to happen in the first place?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think there are many efforts taking place around the state that are aimed at the beetle kill, but I believe there are other sources of fuel than just the spruce that's killed by the beetle. And I think we see that evident in the early part of the season when things are still dry, still you see a lot of the other fuel, and I'm not a fuel expert. We have fuel experts in the room, though. I'm sure we'll be able to address that.
Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Is the entire $1 million for staging and none of it is allocated to operations?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, it's not the Division of Fire Prevention's fiscal note, so I'd rather not speak to that. I think forestry should speak to that. If that's okay.
Thank you, and we do have, excuse me, Lynn Wilcock here, who is the chief of fire and for DNR. I can't read this. Is chief fire and aviation or chief fire? Is that right? Because of, because of our smoke jumpers. Let's have you come up and thank you very much, Fire Marshal Powell. We'll if we have any follow up questions, we'll take that up with you. If you'd state your name for the record and what your capacity is with DNR, please.
Thank you, and it's an honor to be here as well. My name is Lynn Wilcock. I'm the Chief of Fire and Aviation for the Division of Forestry, which is in the Department of Natural Resources. I should also point out that I've been in this job since a week ago today. So.
How is it?
So far, so good.
Any fires?
Not yet. Not yet, but if you came from the valley today, there's not much snow in South Central.
Right.
Testimony?
Yes, please.
I'm sorry. And my apologies being the first time if I forget some of the protocol. I'm sure you'll correct me.
We like firemen. You go, you feel free. You and a few of those guys in that row are the heroes in this room. We're
just doing our jobs. But thank you. The Division of Forestry obviously does support this bill. As was indicated, we are seeing many fires earlier than we have historically. And as Representative Olson pointed out, not only have we seen more fires, but there are more complicated fires, as evidenced by the Tracy Avenue fire started on April 27th quickly. With a slightly different wind, it could have easily threatened not only the city of Homer, but many of the houses on East End Road. And that's just one example, many in the valley as well. It's also, as mentioned, exacerbated by the fuel conditions on the Kenai and Central Mat-Su, and in addition, we're seeing a lot of growth into those same areas where these fires are occurring. Mat-Su Valley growing at a very fast rate, and most of the new development is in places that are prone to fire. That's really all I have. I'll answer any questions, though.
That's excellent. Questions?
I've always kind of wondered about when you have a huge expanse of beetle kill or any kind of dead trees, there's always the fear that the fire will start in June and the winds will whip them up and they'll be so difficult to deal with. Is there any thought to burning them off in the winter when there's a foot of snow on the ground?
Representative Gatto through the chair, did I get that right?
Yes, sir, you did.
Not bad for a weak old guy.
Probably wouldn't work in bark beetle country. What the carrier fuel is in on the Kenai is the chelomigrosis that comes in after the trees are dead, and that's really what carries the fire. It burns from tree to tree through the grass. When it gets to a spruce tree that's got dead needles to the ground or dead branches to the ground, then the tree goes out. It probably would not carry from tree crown to tree crown in the winter.
Even in a 40-knot wind?
Oh, it's possible. I'm not sure I'd want to be the one that struck the match in that 40-mile and then to start the prescribed fire, though. You'd like to be able to control prescribed fire.
Right, a 20-knot wind. I'm sure there's something in there.
And there is. Several of the fires that occurred in the peninsula last year, like the King County Creek Fire and the Fox Creek Fire, they were primarily on the Kenai Wildlife Refuge, and those were allowed to burn on portions of the fire, the sides that were closest to the communities at risk were suppressed, but the rest of it was allowed to burn just to provide that break in the fuel to do some natural cleanup of the dead fuels.
Thank you. I have a question for you, Lynn. To follow on with what Representative Samuels was asking about the fiscal note, being from the interior, and I know you're stationed out of Fort Wainwright, I'm grateful because we had just the last 2 years in the interior has been horrendous for those
Indeed.
Of us that live there. The million-dollar fiscal note, and we just saw in the newspaper that large supplemental budget by the governor. I'm assuming that this $1 million is going to, if we don't allocate for it in the spring, as per Representative Olson's concern, then we're going to see that show up in the supplemental funding request later as part of. I know that. The budget the DNR has had to go back and ask for the supplemental budget has been an enormous amount in the millions of dollars the last couple of years because of the tremendous fire seasons. Do I understand that correctly?
I believe that's a good characterization. And of course, getting the fiscal note here is not going to likely eliminate the need for supplemental some year. We just can't predict what the fire season is going to be like, but we would hope that by being better prepared earlier that several of the fires that become large expensive fires like Tracy Avenue and Boundary we'd have better success at keeping them becoming that large. That's not 100% guaranteed by any means.
I understand. Additional questions for Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up a little bit on what Representative Gatto was saying about possibly burning some of this off in the wintertime, I understand what you said about it wouldn't carry over from from crown to crown, but have you thought about, rather than going out and trying to log this beetle kill spruce, just taking a weed burner and setting individual trees on fire that are dead and providing all this fuel in the wintertime? Because I know that they spend a lot of time going out and cutting the beetle-killed spruce on the hillside and other areas around populated areas. I was just wondering if that was a way to possibly get rid of the fuel.
Representative Crawford, to the chair, the magnitude of the problem on the Kenai Peninsula would probably make that a very expensive proposition. Not that it couldn't be done. You know, there are a number of fuel treatments that were being tried not only in the Kenai but in the Fairbanks areas where things like shear blading in the winter, where we come in with a bulldozer and the root system is frozen, we can shear the trees off right at ground level and leave the root system intact, has proven to be, and then burning the residual piles. That's proven to be an effective method. The other problem with any type of prescribed fire active management, it is the land manager's responsibility, whoever owns the land. On the Kenai, for instance, a large portion of that is the Fish and Wildlife Refuge, and they do have active programs for prescribed burning and mechanical treatments of different types. Where most of the concerns are, of course, are in and around the communities, which are largely private and municipal lands, and then it becomes the responsibility of whoever owns the land to implement those fuels programs. So we have offered our expertise and recommendations. We review fuels plans all the time and will assist with lots of different types of projects. But the Division of Forestry doesn't actually manage the lands directly except on the state forest. So we are usually in an advisory role to help those land managers who actually have that responsibility. That answer your question. One other comment on the logging was there was a very active salvage program in the early days of the bark beetle epidemic. What's happened more recently is the economic value of the dead spruce trees, which primarily went to pulp, has declined because they've been dead so long that the quality of the material has reduced the economic value of those products. Mm-hmm. It's not economical to chip them and ship the chips to some place that can produce low-quality products with it.
That's why I'm saying burn them.
And that's a possibility, but to burn individual trees in the area the size that would need to be treated in the Kenai to make a difference would be a very expensive proposition. One of the question was asked by, I believe, Representative Ledoux about what we can do, and I think the answer there is really it falls to each individual homeowner to take the steps necessary on their property to make it as safe as possible from an encroaching wildfire. And there's been a lot of research in recent years on what that really involves. It's not usually the big raging ground fire that burns down houses. It's embers falling in the grass that's next to the deck that's attached to your house that burns your house down. So sometimes taking steps of just removing the very flammable stuff that's close to things that might not in your house can have the same effect of clearing for 100 acres around your house. But the individual landowner is really the answer to living in the boreal forest where fire has always been and will always be a part of the environment.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I know it's not pertinent to the bill, but I'm curious, what reduces the economic value of a tree when it's been dead for a while? Does it twist? Does it? What happens to that valuable wood?
Well, most of the wood that came off of the Kenai that was chipped for pulp, and I believe the state forester, Chris Mace, is more of a timber guy than I am. I'm the fire guy, but as the dead spruce tree ages, the quality of the fiber declines. So the products that you can make from that fiber become varied and not as, you can't make really good paper from the fiber that has been decaying for a number of years. And although the decay process is slow in Alaska, there still is decay occurring.
I was interested in the logs, particularly for log homes. We used to import them from Montana, and because they were straight or big or something. And then I was interested in something as simple as 2x4s. And when we talk about economic value, I'm not talking about chips. And I know it's not going to help here, but I'm curious to know what happens to a log. The fibers become weakened?
Correct. And so weakened, and also there's an amount of structural integrity that decay. It's primarily a structural decline in the quality of the wood.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't tell you why, Carl, but down in our country where we had the pulp mills, if the log was wasn't taken out, was cut and down 5 years, the sap was gone and the log was useless for pulp once the sap deteriorated.
Are there any additional questions for Mr. Wilcox? I sure hope you have an easy year this year.
Me too.
We all hope for that, but we appreciate you being there to keep our community safe. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chief Goodrich?
Good afternoon. My name for the record is Craig Goodrich. I'm the fire chief in the municipality of Anchorage. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. For us, we're a structural organization, but we do, of course, support the forestry organization because we have people who are red carded and certified to fight wildland fires. For us, however, we support the bill primarily because by moving the fire season in an official recognition to an earlier date, what that does is allow then for the seasonal employees to come back onto line, and we can then begin our training program, which really should be happening in January and February. It's important to note that what happens when the seasonal employees come back and we start the training program, we're already behind the power curve with respect to those people who are the professionals who then reach out to us as structural organizations to begin to come up to speed with all of the training that we need to do to be prepared. So this has a very real impact for us, and I'm sure that that has got to be at least some part of the fiscal note. There is an answer to the question that's been asked on several occasions, what would make the commissioner unable, or how does that affect? The commissioner then has to make the declaration on a case-by-case basis, and looking out then, knowing in advance what we're, the net effect is that he would have to know in advance, be clairvoyant, that it was going to be a bad fire year. And, of course, we won't know that until we're actually in the fire season. So by formally recognizing and institutionalizing the fire season, recognizing it needs to be earlier, that will allow us to be more proactive and to be able to guarantee, well, to be able to plan better for that proactivity. I would like to offer, by the way, that a campaign fire costs $1 million a day. So if we can avoid that, this $1 million, it seems to me, is probably fairly well spent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Goodrich. Are there questions for the Chief?
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation, sir. Michael Davison is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Michael Davidson. I represent the interests of the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. We represent the interests of career firefighters, paramedics in the state of Alaska. I'm also here as a resident. I grew up in Alaska. I'd like to speak in favor today of House Bill 395. As many people have echoed in recent years, we've seen increased dry weather in the spring, increased fire activity. We had, I believe, the largest fire season we've had on record in the state in 2004, a year in which I was sent to Fairbanks to the Haystack subdivision. To me, this is a matter of being proactive versus reactive. It was eye-opening to me to go to Fairbanks and realize we were looking at 400 homes. And so, although certainly a cost of $1 million additional dollars is a serious consideration, and I'm glad to know that people consider that seriously here, I think in light of the potential for the loss of resources and property destruction, that it might be money well spent to ensure that we don't face a multi-million dollar loss, both of resources or property. Strictly from a labor standpoint, for the people I represent, it's much more hazardous for us to fight a fire when it becomes much larger, rather than for us to try and catch it while it's small. And so I don't want the folks that I am obligated to look after having to take increased risk because we weren't proactive in our decisions. That's all I had to add. Stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Any questions for Mr. Davidson? Representative Gatto?
Chris, I have to ask. Have you made much progress in talking to people on hillsides as far as removing fuels from the vicinity of their homes, or are there just more and more homes all the time and you can't quite catch up?
The representative through the chair, that's an excellent question. I actually work at one of the hillside stations in Anchorage, and I believe we've had excellent progress with people on fuel mitigation. In talking to the homeowners and through proactive efforts at the community council level and things like that, as directed by Chief Goodrich, we've been able to really reach out to the community through our FireWise program and educate people as to exactly what they have to do to prepare their homes, to allow their homes to be better defended by us. Outside of Anchorage, when I was in Tok last, I was sent to prep a subdivision, and I met a lady who was so proud that over a 10-year period of Tok, having been threatened repetitively, she'd gone from a house that was considered to be almost indefendable to a house that was hazardous to defend to a house that we had considered very defendable. And I remember coming out and celebrating with us that she had finally achieved that coveted status for herself. But I think that excellent inroads are being made and people being proactive on their own land.
Actually, a couple more. A couple of homes is already $1 million. I mean, there's not much difference. Number two, how about the cost of fire insurance? Is there some connection between how much an individual homeowner is going to be paying for fire insuring their home versus the fact that they've done mitigation and the community has essentially become more aware and the fire season has changed? All those things enter into the calculation for the cost of fire insurance?
To the representative through the chair, I'm actually not an expert in the fire insurance rating, so I don't think I'd be the most appropriate to comment, but certainly I agree that would be interesting as to how that affects someone's insurance rates.
And I ask because it's conceivable that when you reduce a homeowner's fire insurance by $100 a year, but it costs them $50 a year for enhanced fire protection, everybody wins.
And to the representative through the chair, I just might add, I am not an expert on fire insurance, but I'm sure, as you know from your experience also, that that is true in the structural realm, that oftentimes by proactively spending some, in our case, some local funds, we're able to actually offset in a much greater level, reduce people's insurance payments.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Actually, it's not a question, but it's a response to Representative Gatto's question. If the home is within a 10-mile radius of a fire station that would respond, it might have an impact, but if it was beyond 10 miles, it wouldn't.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Davidson. Finally, we have Chris Mache from the Division of Forestry is online with us to answer any questions. Does anybody have any questions for Director of the Division of Forestry? Chris, thanks for staying on the line. We appreciate it, and we got things undercover here. Is there anybody else in the audience here for public testimony? All right, seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. And any committee discussion on this bill? Representative Olson?
I think everything's pretty much been said. It's a good bill, and if I think it'd be money well spent.
Okay, with that, entertain a motion.
I'll move House Bill 395 with attached physical notes and individual recommendations.
Any objections? Without objection, HB 395 passes from the Resource Committee. Thank you very much. All right, with that, it's 2:35, and Resources stands adjourned.